So we really got far last week in our Kuzari share. We're on page 47. We did the first paragraph.
Okay, I'll just leave it.
And let's go to paragraph number two. So in paragraph number one, we say that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi speaks in the first person in the opening paragraph. And he says, I was asked to provide refutations for those philosophies and religions that differ from ours, including those sects of Judaism that descend from traditional Judaism. If you need an explanation of this paragraph, go to koshertube.com and you'll be able to get last week's shiur. We're up to paragraph number two now. And we just need a reader. So who's volunteering to read? Any volunteers? Michelle, go ahead.
This made me remember the arguments of the rabbi who studied with the Khazar king who converted to Judaism some 400 years ago. The king's story is faithfully recorded in history books.
If you want to know the story of the Khazar king who converted to Judaism, tomorrow night you'll get a full shiur about the history of the Khazars. One of the things that you may want to study in preparation of tomorrow night's shiur about the history of the Khazars is an essay in the back of your book. It's in one of the appendices. It's Appendix E on page 635, and it starts with the Chizdai letters. Sometimes it's pronounced Chazdai. Different historians either pronounce it Chizdai or Chazdai. And that gives you the historical background for the Khazars textually. But of course, if you want to get the full story, you got to come to the class tomorrow night. What we're going to do is just provide you a very brief sketch of what the story is all about the Khazars. At least the story that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was familiar with from the Chazdai letters. Chazdai ibn Shaprut was the vizier to the caliph Abd al-Rahman III, who was the caliph in the 10th century of Andalusia, which is southern Spain, which is where the Jews were living under Islamic rule. And he was a Jew. This was one of those periods in Jewish history known as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry, where it was possible for a Jew who was a dhimma, who was not part of the Islamic society, to still rise in the ranks politically and actually become the vizier of the king, of the caliph. And it was an unusual period of Jewish history in the diaspora, but it was considered to be one of the more light-filled periods of Jewish history. And because of his position within government, Chazdai ibn Shaprut had heard about a faraway land where there was an entire country of Jews. And he had no idea who these people were, but through a series of correspondences, and I'll give you the whole story tomorrow, he was able to discover that this was not what he had originally thought. He had originally thought that this country of Khazars were from one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. But in reality, he discovered that it was an entire country of people who had originally been pagans, were heathens, people who had no religion whatsoever. And all of a sudden, the country en masse converted to Judaism based upon a dream that their king whose name was Bulan, according to the Chazdai letters, had over a period of several nights, telling him that he had, and this is the message that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to be telling us in the next paragraph, telling him that something was wrong. And as a result, he converted, and eventually he convinced the majority or a large portion of his kingdom to convert to Judaism. Now, throughout Jewish history, from the time of the Chazdai letters until around the early part of the 20th century, the historicity of the Khazars was always called into question. It was always the legend of the Khazars that people knew. There was always this legend about this nation of Jews, but no one really ever knew whether the Khazars were actually Jewish. We all know that the Khazars existed. They are part of the annals of world history. As a matter of fact, you can go to a bookstore or a library and get something out of the library called a historical atlas. And there are many editions of a historical atlas. You can pull out the historical atlas from the period of the early Middle Ages, and you'll discover that from around the year 600 to around the year 1100 or 1200, there was, so roughly spanning 5 to 6 centuries, there was a territory known as the Khazars, or Khazaria. If you want to know where the map, you want to see a map of the Khazars, so that's in your book too. Just don't remember where in your book it is. I'll tell you what page it's on. If you find the, oh, it's on page 32. So as you can see, the country of Khazaria was situated between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea in an area which we would now call southwestern Russia, or part of larger Mother Russia. It extends all the way up into the Ukraine. You see Kiev, which is the capital of the Ukraine, is part of its western, northwestern border. It goes down into the, where you see where it says the Warsan Mountains. Some people believe that the Warsan Mountains are the Caucasus mountain range, which is right near the Caspian Sea. And that goes down to countries now that are known as Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And so it covers a very large territory. And this was the Khazar kingdom probably in its heyday. So everyone knew that the Khazars existed as a nation. They were eventually overrun and eventually died out. But the question is, who were they? Was the legend true that they were Jews? And furthermore, the legend of how they became Jews, was that true also? And sometime in the early to middle 20th century, archaeologists began to go to this part of the world and were able to unearth archaeological data which proves incontrovertibly that there was a Jewish presence in this part of the world long before the founding of the Russian Empire, which didn't start until around the 12th century. So this archaeological data proves to us, and there's been articles and many books written about the ancient Khazars, that they were indeed there were Jews living here. Whether or not it was the majority of the kingdom, as is professed by the Chasdai letters, is something that historians can debate. But the Chasdai letters themselves are a historical document that, as a matter of fact, the cover of this book is a fragment of the Chasdai letters that is on display in one of the museums. It's in Cambridge University Library. So that's a fragment from I don't know whether it's an original of the Chasdai letters or whether it's a transcription, an old manuscript transcription of the Chasdai letters, but there was a correspondence between Chasdai ibn Shaprut sometime in the 10th century and King Joseph, who was a descendant himself of King Bulan, who had converted to Judaism sometime before. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, according to his records, tells us that the conversion took place some 4 centuries ago. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Levi is writing this around the year 1100, thereabouts, maybe a little bit later than that. So he's placing the conversion of the Khazars at sometime in the early 8th century. But historians are not so sure about Rabbi Yehuda Levi's timeline, and they think that it might have been actually a little bit later in the 8th century, perhaps in the 9th or even perhaps even as late as the 10th century. But that's not really relevant to Rabbi Yehuda Levi's discussion. He's not the historian. And what we really have to figure out is if this is a book about Hashkafa, this is a book about Jewish theology and Jewish thought, what do we care about the Khazars? And that's really going to be the theme of our discussion today. We're not really going to spend a lot of time talking about who the Khazars were. That'll be tomorrow night. Tomorrow night will be your history lesson. And today we're going to talk about why Rabbi Yehuda Levi cares about the Khazars. Okay? So let's talk about, let's go on to paragraph 3, and then maybe we'll get, Michelle, please help us with paragraph 3.
It begins with the king having a recurrent dream of an angel who appears to him and tells him, "Your intentions are desirable to the Creator, but not your deeds." The king had become deeply engrossed in the Khazar religion to the point that he himself would administer in the Khazar shrine and tend to the sacrifices which he did with a full heart. But even though he would become involved with these rites, he would still be visited in a dream at night by the angel, who would continually tell him, "Your intent is desirable, but your deeds are not."
So here's a king who is haunted by an angel in a dream, who is telling him something's wrong, Your intentions are desirable. I see that you have a good heart. I see that your desires to be a good person are very well placed. But there's something missing, and that is what? Your deeds. So the king originally thought, okay, fine. So I'm just not davening enough, and I'm not worshiping the idols enough. So he went more frequently to the shrines, and he offered more incense and more sacrifices to the gods. But that didn't placate the angel. The angel kept coming back to him in the dream, telling him the exact same thing. One of the other things we're going to discuss tomorrow is the interesting difference between Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's account of the story and the original account of the story as it appears in the Chasdai letters. So if you want to sort of get a head start and you want to read the story as it appears in the Chasdai letters in the appendix, you'll be able to pick up a very important distinction, or two or three distinctions that you can find in the Halevian account of the story, which really suits his purposes, as we'll discuss, and the account as it appears in the Chasdai letters. So let's go to paragraph number 4, please.
This prompted the king to explore other belief systems and religions. Ultimately, the king, together with the great populace of Khazars, converted to Judaism. Many of the rabbi's arguments have given me peace of mind and are in accord with my own thinking.
Read 5, please.
I have therefore decided to record the arguments in dialogue form as they were originally presented. Hopefully, perceptive readers will gain much understanding from them.
These arguments. And I sort of took liberty with that translation, because the Hebrew just says "V'hamaskilim yavinu," that perceptive people will understand. Anytime you find someone in especially older Judaic writing saying "V'hamaskilim yavinu," what do you think that really is referring to? "V'hamaskilim yavinu" really is trying to tell me that there's more here than meets the eye. I'm writing esoterically. I'm sort of embedding a secret to the people. The smart people will be able to figure it out. And what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is referring to is the fact that he had no idea what the conversation between the Khazar king and this rabbi was. And historians basically point out to us that there is no record of a dialogue between the rabbi who visited the Khazar king and the king himself. Since we don't know exactly what happened, all we know is, according to the Chasdai letters, that is the historical basis for this whole story, is that the king was visited by three different clerics from the three different major faiths, the Western faiths. The king was visited by a Muslim imam, or what's really more correctly, a qadi, which is an Islamic judge, sort of like a dayan. He was visited by a priest, and he was visited by what's in Arabic, they call it a haber, which is really the best way to translate is a Talmud Chacham or a rabbi. And so in the course of the disputations that the king was able to hear from these three clerics, he was able to conclude that he needed to choose the faith of Judaism. That's why did he summon these three religionists? He summoned them because he concluded that there must be something he's missing in the current way that he's practicing his faith. And so he figured, there must be something that I can learn from the other faiths that are outside of my kingdom. Let me bring in three, you know, major religions and see what they have to say. And maybe I'll be able to learn about what I'm supposed to be doing from them. So he summons three clerics, according to the Chasdai letters. And this is one of the major departures that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi creates from the original story, because if you're perceptive, you'll notice that it's not three in the Halevian account in the Khuzari, but it's rather four. And who do you think Rabbi Yehuda Halevi adds in his new cast of characters? There's a rabbi, there's a priest, sounds like a joke, a rabbi, a priest, and a qadi. And who's the fourth one?
Philosopher.
The philosopher, exactly. And the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi story, which is not the original story, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has adulterated it in order to be able to present what he feels he needs to present, he adds a fourth cleric, so to speak, which is the philosopher, who's not even a member of any faith at all. And as we'll see, a lot of people think that the Khuzari, when they first read it, they just read the first few pages of it, and they come to the conclusion, oh, this is a polemic against Christianity and Islam. Not at all. This is not a polemic against Christianity and Islam. Christianity and Islam are dispensed with in about 5 minutes out of a very long book. And if this were indeed a polemic against Christianity and Islam, it would be a very, very poor work indeed. Because in order to be able to effectively dispute something that you disagree with, you can't put words in the mouth of your opponent and say, he said five words and one argument, and on that basis I was able to dismantle him very easily. That's not a very good disputation. It's not a very good way of, even if I want to write a book on the defense of Judaism, I want to show, if my objective is to show that Christianity is false, I don't dismiss it in a page. I spend a large amount of time explaining why Christians believe what they believe, what church doctrine is, and where the errors are. But if you notice, Rabbi Yehuda Levi spends virtually no space at all on church doctrine. He has a few short paragraphs, and by the way, those paragraphs were actually censored out of some editions because Jews throughout most of our diaspora history had Christian clerics looking over our shoulder, making sure that we were writing things that were not unflattering to the church. And they were reinstated at some point later. And the same thing, he devotes a few lines for the Qadi, puts some words in his mouth explaining what Muslims believe. And then he moves on and he spends pages on the philosopher. And the philosopher is not even part of the original story. That's the irony. So what we need to understand is, clearly Rabbi Yehuda Levi had an agenda. And his agenda had nothing to do with the story of the Khazars. It had to do with his need, as we mentioned last week, to try and provide a cogent analysis and presentation of Judaism to his generation, which would impress upon them that Judaism was every bit as sophisticated and modern as the secular Islamic society's presentation of what philosophy and religion were all about. And that any kind of appearance of an archaic nature to Judaism was really only a mirage, was really only an illusion, but that really Judaism is still the superior faith, it's the original and it's still number one, and you'll find all the answers to what you're looking for within Judaism. He chooses a platform, and the platform that he chooses is the story of the Khazar king. And what we have to understand is he could have chosen any story. Now let me just point out, the methodology that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi employs is not original. In other words, what he's going to do is provide us with a play, almost, a dialogue between primarily two characters in this play, the rabbi and the Khazar king, and we're going to introduce at the beginning of the book a few other cameo appearances. We'll have an appearance by the philosopher, we'll have an appearance by the priest and by the Qadi, but primarily the book is really a dialogue between these two stars of our play. This is what's known as, it's one of the methodologies known as the Socratic method, right? Which is to be able to provide information in dialogue form by creating characters, fictional characters, who present information in the dialogue format. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Levi is using a method that, from a literary point of view, is very popular in the medieval period. It was introduced by Plato in his Republic, who lived many centuries before. lived in the early Middle Ages, medieval period, it's ancient civilization, Plato. He writes a book about Greek philosophy, but he presents it from the viewpoint of his Rebbe, Socrates, and he's having this dialogue with Socrates. That's why it's called the Socratic method. And in the course of writing this book, Plato's Republic, he presents his view on what life is all about. So this concept of using a cast of fictional characters to present your information is very, very popular. Other great Jewish authors have done the same. One of the most famous works on Jewish mysticism and deeper Jewish thought, or esoteric thought, is from the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, wrote a book called Da'at Tevunot. which they translate as the knowing heart, I think is what the working translation of it. Anyone have the Luzzatto's book called Das Tavunos, The Knowing Heart? It's in English, you can get it. It's a very, very important work by Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the same author as Nesilas Yeshorim and Derech Hashem. And he wrote a book, which is a little bit more deep than Nesilas Yeshorim and Derech Hashem, trying to explain some of the deeper patterns of the way, what God had in mind when he created the world. And he presented in dialogue form between the nefesh and the seichel, between the soul and the intellect. The soul and the intellect are not living people. This is not a real conversation, but it's a Socratic method of engaging the reader. Now, why do people do that? Why would an author seek to create this kind of dialogue when he presents information? There are a number of reasons for this. It's actually much more engaging to read about two people talking than it is to get a straight lecture, right? So that's why everyone's bored when I speak. But if we engage in a conversation, then it's much more interesting. As a matter of fact, there's a medrash that says a very beautiful story, which many of you may be familiar with, because it's a very famous medrash about the evils of lashon hara. And the medrash goes like this: that one day Rabbi Yannai was sitting on his mirpeset, sitting on the porch, and he's listening out what's going out in the shuk. And all of a sudden, he hears a peddler in the city of Tzipori, which is where he's living, saying, "Man boi sama dechaye, man boi sama dechaye." Who wants the elixir of life? Who wants the elixir of life? And so he's very curious. So he goes over to the peddler, and he says, "Please, sell some to me. I'd like to buy some of your elixir of life." And he says, "You and your colleagues do not need what I have to sell." And he says, "Why not?" He says, "Because you already have the elixir of life." And he pulls out Sefer Tehillim, and he pulls out the pasuk in Tehillim, which says, "Mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chayim," who is the man who desires life? "Ohev yamim liros tov," who wants to be able to have a good life and to see the days of his life prolonged. And what is the answer to the question? "Nitzor l'shoncha me'raus v'asecha midaber mirmah," guard your tongue from evil. And so forth, and you know, sur me'rav ha'aseh tov, turn away from evil and do good, v'akesh alam v'rodfeu, seek out peace and pursue it. So Rabbi Yannai then comments on his experience, and he says, "My whole life I've been reading that pasuk in Tehillim, and I never really understood it until the peddler pointed out to me its meaning." That's the end of the medrash. Fascinating medrash. Beautiful medrash. Our kids know the medrash. Problem is, the medrash makes no sense. Because when you think about the story, what did Rabbi Yannai really learn from the peddler? The Medrash doesn't tell us what he learned from him. It seems at face value, all the peddler was showing him was a pasuk in Tehillim saying that if you want to live, you should not speak lashon hara. So what did Rabbi Yannai learn from the peddler? One of the mefarshim on the Medrash explains that Rabbi Yannai was always bothered with the format of the information that was contained in the pesukim in Tehillim. Why did David HaMelech choose to ask a question? "Mi ha'isha chafetz chayim," who is the man who desires life? Why did he ask it as a question? That's not how usually you find information being transmitted in Tanakh. Usually if the Tanakh has a message, an aphorism or a teaching that it wants to get across, it'll just say, you know, "He who desires life should guard his tongue from evil." So why does he ask it as "Mi ha'ish"? Who's the man who wants life? So Rabbi Yannai said, "You know what the peddler taught me? He taught me that if you want to grab someone's attention, you got to ask him a question. What do you think? What do you think?" Right? Engage the listener instead of just giving them over straight information. So let me ask you. So why do you think Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote his book using the Socratic method? What do you think? What's the answer? No? He wants to grab our attention, right? So in other words, that's the whole point of writing a book in this way. It's actually a very important way. We learn a lot about pedagogy from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi as well. If you want to be a good teacher, engage your students. Make them part of the dialogue. Bring them in. Draw them in. And of course, when you're writing a book, it's much harder to draw your students in because you can't have the give and take that you would normally have in a classroom setting. So the best alternative to that is create a dialogue where you're setting up this two sides of this of the argument. You create a sympathetic two sympathetic characters. You say, one, this guy says this way, hey, he makes sense. But then the other guy says the other thing, he makes sense too. And then you feel the struggle, you feel the tension, and you feel drawn in into the dialogue, into the dispute. So that's what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is really doing. Now let's get back to the history of this. There is no record of the dialogue, and actually some of the Jewish history books tell us that really, I mean, there are three different theories that are brought down in some of the pre-20th century history books. Either the whole story was made up and there never were Khazars, but that's pretty much debunked because we know historically there were Khazars and they were Jewish. Either Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is to be taken literally when he says, I have therefore decided to record the arguments in dialogue form as they were originally presented. He must have had some kind of transcript, but that's extremely unlikely. It's extremely unlikely because in the time that we're dealing with, which is 8th or 9th century, it was very uncommon for there to be recorded dialogue of conversations that would exist between in a private setting between two people having a disputation about religion, and that it should be preserved for all posterity and then translated from the Khazar language into either Arabic or Hebrew is extremely far-fetched. It's therefore more likely that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had the account that we know that he had of, because it's recorded historically that Jews of Andalusia in the 12th century had a record of the annals or the letters of Chasdai ibn Shaprut and his correspondence with King Joseph, a descendant of this King Bulan that we're reading about now. And in that account, we read nothing about the nature of the disputation other than the fact that the rabbi used very convincing words in order to draw the king towards Judaism. And the king actually, in the Chasdai letter account, actually already had an inkling from the angel that visited him in the dream that Judaism was the answer. But Rabbi Yehuda Halevi doesn't get to that because that would defeat the objective of his story. He's more interested in trying to explain to us how Judaism intellectually is satisfying purely from a purely objective point of view, not because of what an angel tells you, but rather because you will discover as you read the words of this dialogue how sensible Judaism is, especially when compared to all of the Chazarai that's out there. All right. So therefore, what makes most sense and what most historians agree to is that when Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, "I have therefore decided to record the arguments in dialogue form," he's giving a little wink to his audience, and therefore, when he says "Vahamaskilim Yavinu," wink, wink, you know what I mean. You know what we're talking about. This is part of the story that I'm going to present to you, in order for us to be able to be drawn into this very thrilling and interesting story of the Khazar king versus the rabbi. Who was the rabbi? Rabbi Yehuda Halevi doesn't care. But there are historians who have pointed out that his name was Rabbi Yitzchak Kasingari, from a place called Singar. I'm not really sure where that is. It may be Shanghai, it may be Singapore. I don't know exactly where ancient Singar is, but if anyone wants to do the research, that's the name that he is attributed with. And he was known as a medieval traveler among the Jewish people. There have been many medieval travelers, by the way. You know, there's a whole book that's available in English called Jewish Travelers, which is still in print. It was published many, many decades ago. And you can find it on Amazon. And it has a whole series of different texts going back to the medieval period about ancient Jewish travelers who went to really exotic places and encountered experiences which enhanced their Jewish experience. Many times it talks about Jewish travelers who encounter Jews who come from very foreign places, Jews who encounter travelers who are from the 10 lost tribes. A very famous book called the Book of Eldad Hadani. Eldad Hadani is a medieval character who came all of a sudden somewhere around the 11th century and comes to Europe and represents himself as being from the lost tribe of Dan. He was living in Ethiopia at the time. and he records how he had crossed the Sambachon River, which was this great river, according to Talmudic tradition, which divided all of the other Jews from the 10 lost tribes, and how it was impossible to cross the river except on Shabbat, when the river would come to a rest. And many, many other very, amazing kinds of things like that. And there's actually a book that you can find in the Beis Medrash in Yeshiva called Hilchos Shchita LeElder Hadani, the Laws of Ritual Slaughter, according to the Mesorah of Elder Hadani. Because a lot of times, Elder Hadani would say, I have a tradition that goes back to the First Temple period, when we were still part, when we were still all together, and this is how we used to do Shchita. So it's actually a sefer like that you can find in the Beis Medrash. Anyway, so there are a number of different stories about Jewish travelers. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and his entire community were enthralled by these stories. They were certainly familiar about the story about the Khazar king, because it involved Spanish Jewish history, because Chasda ibn Shaprut, who was probably the highest ranking, he and Rabbi Shimon Gavirol and Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid, all of these people were very high ranking Jews within the Spanish world preceding Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. And the Jews of the community were very proud of these people. These were folk heroes. And the Khazar story was therefore a folk tale that everyone was very, very proud of in the early 12th century. So that's why he's using this story. Now, we really haven't gotten to the real reason why he's using this story. And I think with this I'm going to conclude. I want you to think very carefully that in presenting a dialogue, you can choose any characters you want. As I mentioned, the Ramchal had chosen two characters which are not people at all. He had chosen the Seichel and the Nefesh, right, which are just two voices speaking, but aren't really personages at all. Why did Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi choose the Khazar king and the rabbi? He could have chosen any two people if he was interested in engaging. The key to the story is the words of the Malach that we read in the top paragraph, which are, your intent is desirable, kavanascha ritsuya etzel habore, that your intentions are desirable to the Creator, u'ma'asecha einam ritsuyim, but your actions are not. Your actions are undesirable. We are seeing a foreshadowing very early on in the book to what the entire theme of Sefer HaKuzari is all about. And if we're going to encapsulate the entire theme of Sefer HaKuzari in one sentence, it is that one sentence that the angel tells the Khazar king. It's not about intentions, it's about actions. That's what Judaism is. Judaism is a religion of deed and not a religion of creed. Your belief system, your ideology, your theology, your set of dogma that you subscribe to has nothing to do with Judaism. Judaism, as it's presented to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Torah, is all about how a Jew is supposed to behave. And the reason for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is that his understanding of Torah is that the actions that we do with our bodies creates a magical transformation not only ourselves, but of the entire world around us. And indeed, the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a Torah that is so replete with bodily commandments is because he gave us the knowledge to know how to use the tremendous power that each and every one of us possesses to transform ourselves in the world through physical action. That, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, is what Yiddishkeit is in a nutshell. The Maisa HaMitzvos, the performance of the mitzvos, have a supernatural effect on all of creation. And if anything, trying to use your intellect, trying to use your mind, to try and understand intellectually what I'm supposed to do as a Jew is actually a terrible, terrible waste. Because your mind is a terrible thing to waste. No, that's exactly the opposite of what Rito Levi is saying. He's saying it's a tremendous waste to use your mind in employing an intellectual understanding of how to be Jewish. Because being Jewish has nothing to do with an intellectual understanding of the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs far transcend human intellection. They far transcend any kind of rational understanding of how my shaking of a lulav in some way affects and resonates throughout the cosmos. It is something that is supernatural, something that is metaphysical, that cannot be explained in normative terms. God has a way of understanding it. He gave us the mitzvot not because he said, now go and understand them. You look through the Torah, and you'll find that almost every single mitzvah that is given to us in the Torah is without an explanation. God didn't say, shake the lulav because you'll become one with the environment, and you'll be one with the trees, and you'll move like the trees, and you'll become special, and you'll be trained. No, Hashem says, shake the lulav. And the lulav has this magical effect that transcends human understanding. And therefore, what is the message that the angel gives to the Khazar king? He says, your intentions are great. I see that you're sincere. But religion without proper conduct, because you've been wandering in the darkness trying to figure this out on your own. But the reality is that this world is so complex and so magical and so supernatural that without proper guidance, you'll never figure this out on your own. You need to seek out the answers from a divine source, which you would never be able to figure out on your own. And that's really what the angel is telling the Khazar king. And that's the message that Rabbi Yehuda Levi is trying to tell us. And you know why that message is so relevant for Rabbi Yehuda Levi's generation? Is because you think it's all about intellectual pursuits? You think it's all about highfalutin wisdom and understanding and doctrine and dogma? He says, then you're lost. You're just as lost as the Khazar king who thinks that he can figure this out on his own. He says, your intentions may be wonderful, but if you don't have the proper divine guidance to tell you how you're supposed to live your life, you'll never get it. So don't think that the philosophers have anything to offer you. The philosophers are the exact opposite message of what the Torah message is. The Torah message is do the mitzvot. The philosophers say think about God. And when you think about God, you'll find perfection. And Rabbi Yehuda Levi says your thoughts, that's you're lost with just your thoughts. God gave you a body for a reason. He gave you mitzvahs. Take a look at how many of the Taryag mitzvahs have to do with thinking. It's true, there is a percentage. There's a mitzvah of loving Hashem. There's a mitzvah of affirming Hashem's unity. There's a mitzvah of believing in Hashem. Right? All of these things are true. But look at the totality of the mitzvahs, the vast majority. Are mitzvahs that have to do with what you're supposed to do with your life. How you're supposed to behave as a Jew. How you're supposed to bring a carbon. How you're supposed to shake a lulav. How you're supposed to blow a shofar. How you're supposed to serve God in a number of different ways, whether it's on the Shabbos or whether it's on the Yom Tovim. And all of these things are codified in the Torah because Judaism is about action. It's about behavior. So that's what I'm going to leave you with for today.